It's going to be an interesting passage, as was evident as Mark read it. There are a lot of interesting points where humor comes up, but in addition, John is telling us some things that are just absolutely astounding that I didn't realize at all about the passage until the past couple of days, and it's just really going to be an exciting passage. I'm going to be making some changes in observations as to the location and the participants. So there are some interesting things that will go on. Where should we begin? This is Alex Davis, age 23. January 13th, 2008, something monumental occurred in his life. During birth, the link between Alex Davis's eyes and his brain was damaged. As a result, Alex was 100% blind from birth. He never saw anything ever. On January 13th of this year, he underwent an experimental procedure in Washington State. Doctors sought to reconnect his eyes to his brain. For 2 days, patches covered his eyes, allowing initial healing to occur. Many people doubted that the procedure would work. Alex himself had no idea what to expect. As he said, people always tried to tell, to describe sight to me, but it's just something you cannot describe. Doctors removed the patches on January 15th in the presence of many of his family members. Doctors removed the patches. His first sensation was burning pain that caused overwhelming fear. It was not until he heard the voices of family members that he calmed down. As of 2 months after the surgery, in March, he still had difficulty identifying objects by sight alone. But if you put it in his hands, he could readily identify it, and he's been working at associating his visual images with the tactile images that he had become used to in his 23 years. Now, 9 months after his operation, he is finishing up his 3 times per week therapy classes. In his 23 years, he had become quite well adapted to being blind. But now suddenly, he has needed to adjust to being able to see. It has been a major transition in his life. His doctors commented that this is the very first time that surgery has ever taken someone who never saw anything to having complete vision. And that was earlier this year. Now we can indeed rejoice with Alex Davis, his family, the doctors, at the great thing that has happened in his life. This is truly wonderful that we live in an era where medical science has reached the point that even something that seemed as impossible as this could happen. But you know, something even more significant happened 1976 years ago on the streets of Jerusalem, where without surgical instruments, there was a man that Jesus healed and he instantly saw. Didn't even have to have eye patches that had to remain in place for 48 hours. We're going to look at that passage. Consider with me John chapter 9. Now, we need to give a little bit of background, and this is where some of my discoveries have occurred on this passage here within the... Okay, Joseph... One more time. Thank you. We need to look at the chronology of John chapters 8 through 10. Now, when we look at the Gospel of John, it's sort of like the observation that I made to my mother. One day, I pulled out all the 8mm films, and I was watching all kinds of films that we had, you know, home movies. And I asked her, after I had done that, why is it that we don't have any pictures around the house? She said, well, you know, when we travel, that's when we think about pulling out the camera. The Gospel of John is when Jesus goes traveling. It's mainly about the time that Jesus spent in Jerusalem. Matthew, Mark, and Luke focus on all of Jesus' time up north in Galilee with very little attention to the times that he's away in, for example, Jerusalem. But when you look at John's gospel, he tells us this feast came up and Jesus went to Jerusalem. Another feast occurred and Jesus went to Jerusalem. And it's the times that he's in Jerusalem. Now, there's a simple reason for that. Where were the religious experts of the country? Jerusalem. If John showed us Jesus making a claim to be Messiah and he was up in Galilee all the time, wouldn't the natural question arise? Why didn't he go down to Jerusalem? What did the religious leaders think? So when John is proving who Jesus is, it's very important for him to show him in Jerusalem. But that's not where he spent most of his time. Let's consider John chapter 8. In John 8, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he is there for the Feast of Tabernacles. Now let's back up just a little bit to John chapter 7. John chapter 7, verse 1, which is not a statement about the future, but it's Jesus' past policy because he had not been to Jerusalem for a whole year. So Jesus moved about in Galilee since he didn't want to travel in Judea because Judeans were trying to kill him. And then we have his brothers seeking to persuade him to go down to Jerusalem to show himself that he might again have large numbers of disciples as people saw what it is that he did. So in John chapter 7, we have Jesus up in Galilee talking with his brothers, his half-brothers. And then if we drop down to verse 14, now when the festival, it was an eight-day festival, was already half over, Jesus went up into the temple courts and began to teach. There had been speculation by Judean officials, would Jesus show up for this feast? Would he be there? Well, now drop your eyes further down into the chapter, verse 37. Now on the last and most important day of the festival. Now actually, that's a reference to the seventh day of the festival because that was the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles proper. Following that was an eighth day, and that eighth day was a Sabbath. Now, if you remember, the people lived in booths that they made out of palm branches and so forth for six nights. Why was it that they only stayed in that six nights? Why didn't they stay seven nights? Because the eighth day was a Sabbath, and they would have to take apart their booths on a high Sabbath. John chapter 8 occurs on the eighth day of the festival. Let's see how we are able to reach that conclusion. We saw that in verse 37, we have an introduction to the eighth day. And notice what verse 53, assuming, of course, you have a version of the Bible that tells you that that's part of your Bible. There are some versions that do not accept the manuscript tradition saying that these verses belong here. But notice in verse 53, so each one went to his house, and Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. They didn't go into the booths because the booths were already taken down. So people went home. But early the next morning, where was Jesus? John chapter 8, verse 2. But at the break of dawn, Jesus went to the temple courts again, and all the people were coming to him. And in John chapter 8, we have Jesus teaching, and then various things happen as the Pharisees tried to engage him in arguments. But this is a high Sabbath because it's the eighth day of the feast. Okay, we are able to date John chapter 8 as occurring on September the 17th of the year 32. Now, if you look at your notes, you'll remember this chart that I presented when we were teaching in John chapter 7. We are able to relate events between John's chronology and Luke's chronology. Now, John focuses on Jesus in Jerusalem, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke focus on Jesus in Galilee. But there is a section of Luke, chapter 9, verse 51 through 19:28, that focuses on Jesus' last three trips down to Jerusalem. The first one of those trips is point 8. Luke 9:51 through 13:21. That trip happened in between John 8 and John 10. So if you notice here on the screen, that's where I put it. John 8 happens first. Then Jesus made a trip down to Jerusalem, but you say, hey, wait a moment, he's already in Jerusalem. Ah, yes, he made a trip north too. And then he returns down to Jerusalem in order to be present for the Feast of Hanukkah. John chapter 10, verse 22, is Jesus at the Feast of Hanukkah. Take a look at chapter 10, verse 22. Now, it was the Feast of Dedication, that's another name by which Hanukkah goes, in Jerusalem, and it was winter. So we have a three-month transition between the end of John chapter 8 on September 17th of the year 32 and 3 months later to the day John chapter 10 verse 22 begins. Okay, Jesus made a trip north somewhere in between here in order that he could make a trip south. But the question becomes, when did he make the trip? Did he make it before chapter 9? Or did he make the trip after John 10:21? And what I'm going to say is Jesus was in Jerusalem, as we have indicated here on the chart, point 7 of the chart that's in your notes. He was in Jerusalem from John 7:11 up through 10:21. Then he went north to Galilee. And then point 8 mentions in Luke his trip back down to Jerusalem. And so then point 9, his ministry in Jerusalem at the Feast of Hanukkah, starts in John chapter 10, verse 22. And you might say, okay, it's nice to know this. Is there any reason that it's important? Well, I'm sure glad you asked. Yes, it is. It is extremely important. Drop down to the bottom of page 1 of your notes. two issues in John chapter 9, verses 1 through 10:21, place this passage at the time of the Feast of Booths. There are two issues that we can find here. Rather than saying that chapters 9 and 10 up through verse 21, they're being connected to the previous feast rather than to the feast that follows. The first thing is, remember in John chapter 7 that Jesus declared himself to be the light of the world. Remember how at the Feast of the Feast of Tabernacles, how there was a lighting of the court of the women, and it was so brightly lit up at night that people could see all the light emanating from the temple because of the lighting of the court of the women. And Jesus said that he is the light of the world. And what is it that Jesus says in the presence of this blind man? Let's start at John chapter 9, verse 4. I must do the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. He's picking up on the same imagery that he spoke about in John chapter 7. But he also is dealing with the pool of Siloam. And that pool of Siloam receives its water from the spring of Gihon. And you remember, at the Feast of Tabernacles, they had a water ceremony. And the priests would go down out of the city, and they would descend all the way down to the spring of Gihon, and they would bring water from that spring up for a ceremony in the temple. So what we see is some imagery that Jesus spoke about in John chapters 7 and 8, finding their way here into John chapter 9, where Jesus is continuing to illustrate truth that he had taught. But then there's another really interesting little detail. This second thing that connects chapters 8 and 9 is something that if you blink, you'll miss it. One of our problems is, you know, we look at our Bible and we see these big numbers in front of verses. And we see passages being broken up into paragraphs. So let's take a look at chapter 8, verse 59. Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple courts, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now as he was passing by. In both occurrences, it's the word parago, to leave someplace. Now, as you can imagine, there are many times in John's gospel where Jesus left a place, right? But John only uses this word twice in his gospel. And where does he use it? Right next to each other. And it's going to open up something really, really fascinating in this passage. Now, I've got to tell you, though, most people would argue that John chapter 9 happened on a completely different day than John chapter 8. Because here you have all these guys with their rocks that are ready to stone Jesus. And so if Jesus just goes a little way down the hill and stays in Jerusalem, why aren't all these guys with their rocks running after him and trying to throw the rocks at him? How is it that he can very calmly talk with a blind man and set up the circumstances where the man is able to go his way to the Pool of Siloam, come back, and then be taken off to the Pharisees, and there to be an interrogation, and then for them to call his parents, and for the interrogation to continue, and then for Jesus to go find the man and make remarks to him while there are Pharisees watching him? And you say, wouldn't we expect that if the Pharisees of John chapter 8 were around Jesus that same day, when they wanted to throw stones at him, wouldn't they throw stones at him now? So guess what? Most people say this didn't happen on the same day. You can see why they don't think it happened on the same day, but you can also see why I would say it did. And it is just fascinating how this passage opens up and shows us how this made perfect sense. So if you turn to page 2 in your notes, we'll look at a couple of pictures. The temple is circled, especially the temple proper, where the holy place and holy of holies, where the court of the women was. Remember, Jesus was speaking in the temple in the vicinity of the treasury for John chapter 8. So he's right there in the middle of that circle. And where is it that he went down to? At the bottom, you'll see another circle, and you'll see the Pool of Siloam marked down there. And Jesus told the man who was blind to go and wash in the Pool of Siloam. Let me ask you a question. How far are you going to tell a blind man to go? I don't think that the Pool of Siloam was very far away from the man's house. What do you think? Furthermore, there was a rule in first century Judaism that was called the Sabbath journey. Take a look at the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 12. Acts chapter 1, verse 12. It's kind of an interesting little detail here. Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet. A different Greek form, sometimes it will say the Mount of Olives. It means the same thing. It's the same place. Which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey. In other words, if someone started out at the Mount of Olives and they walked to Jerusalem, and it was a Sabbath, that was as far as they were legally allowed to walk in that day. They couldn't make a return trip. They had already exhausted all of their distance that they could cover in that day. Now, isn't it interesting? Take a look at John chapter 8, verse 1 and 2. Which we had talked about earlier. Remember, the eighth day of the feast was a high Sabbath. It was such a high Sabbath that the people were not allowed to live in their booths on the seventh night because they'd have to take apart the booth on the eighth day, which would be a high Sabbath. So in verse 53 of John 7, it said, "So each one went to his house." And Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. So it's not a Sabbath yet, but now the next morning. But at the break of dawn, Jesus went to the temple courts again. Jesus walked from the Mount of Olives over to the temple. guess what? He's used up his Sabbath day's journey. Okay, well, let's start looking at this a little more closely. Here is a cutaway of the mount on which the temple is located, and you'll notice that blue line that's running through here. This is the Tunnel of Siloam. The city of Jerusalem, back in Hezekiah's time, Hezekiah put in a major building project to build a tunnel so that their water supply could be protected, because if you are a city and your water supply is outside the city walls and someone lays siege, you're in pretty sad shape. So they made this tunnel. And the tunnel goes from the spring of Gihon over to the Pool of Siloam, and that's where this water arises from that at this pool. But do notice, it's a considerable distance to get between the Temple Mount and the location here of the Pool of Siloam. Furthermore, it's a pretty steep hill. Now, if you think about the grapevine up there towards Bakersfield, that's pretty steep, right? That's a 6.5% grade. This is a 12.5% grade. This is a very steep way down, and it's a considerable distance. Let's look at it here from a modern picture. You can see here that this is a bit of elevation, and it's a bit of a distance. Now, this is at the Holy Land Hotel, and it's a model of Jerusalem, and you get another picture of the relationship between the temple with the larger circle that's higher, and then the lower one is there at the Pool of Siloam. Now, we talked about a Sabbath day's journey. If one is to travel this distance, this is a Sabbath day's journey. But down to the Pool of Siloam is a longer distance. Here we have, up at the temple, all those people that wanted to throw stones at Jesus. He escaped from their midst, and he went more than a Sabbath day's journey away, and guess what? Nobody followed him, because he went too far. None of the legalists would go that far. Now, they didn't think it was work to pick up their stones and to stone someone, but they would think of it as too much work to walk the distance to the Pool of Siloam. What this means is that for the implications on the geography and chronology of John 9, point one, Jesus was safely out of the reach of the Pharisees who had tried to kill of a local synagogue that was close to the Pool of Siloam. And so therefore, point four, the Pharisees who were with Jesus in John 9:40, again, were not the ones that were mentioned in John 8. So what happened? In John chapter 8, we had demonstrations that Jesus was the Christ in front of one group of Pharisees. And in John chapter 9, we have another demonstration that Jesus is the Christ in front of another group of Pharisees. And neither one of them was able to disprove what Jesus was saying. But it was two separate groups, and although he was only less than a mile away, he was safe from the first group because it was a Sabbath day and they wouldn't walk that far. So this is a very interesting set of things that happens. Okay, let's now start with our new exposition. Jesus saw a man born blind as he walked after leaving the temple. So his disciples asked whether the man's sin or his parents' sin led to his blindness. Chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Now as he was passing by, he saw a man who had been blind from birth, and his disciples questioned him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now, they knew that apart from sin, there would not be sickness, infirmity, or death. But they assumed that because one individual was born blind, that that was directly caused by sin by the man, somehow in the womb, or it was caused by his parents. They were stretching. We can say, as a general concept, there would not be sin, there would not be sickness, infirmity, or death if it had not been for sin. But you can't say, oh, someone has a physical problem, therefore that person sinned. They were reaching, they were going too far, they were saying too much. So Jesus said that sin is not what caused the man's blindness. But the man's blindness was an opportunity for God to work in healing him. So in verse 3, "Neither this man sinned nor his parents," Jesus replied, "but this came about so that God's works might be displayed in him." Jesus added to that, that it was necessary for Christ, the sent one, to do the sender's work, that is, the Father's work, during the day, when he, as the light of the world, is still shining on earth. Now, this is making a play, or I can make a play on words in English. It doesn't quite work exactly the same way in Greek, but you know, the difference between sunshine, S-O-N, shine, versus S-U-N, shine. He, as the light of the world, is pointing back to what John said in his prologue, that he enlightens every man coming into the world. God used Christ to make it so that people could see the truth of his granting of life to believers and to see who indeed he is. There was plenty of evidence. And what he's saying is, he's the light of the world. Now, that didn't end when he left planet Earth through his death, his burial, and his ascension. But he's saying that he in particular is able to enlighten people as he's present on earth, and it's important that he do the work while he is here. That is what he is saying here at this point. He says in verse 4, "I must do the works of the one who sent me while it is day." Can't wait, because only about 6 months later, Jesus is going to be crucified. He is needing to shine as the light in the world right then while he's there. And he said, as long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. He's saying, it's my responsibility to shine light on the truth. And how better to illustrate it than with a man who's been in darkness for Jesus to make it so that he can see. That man first sees physically, and after a while, he's seeing very clear spiritually as well. Jesus is using this to teach a lesson to his disciples. Well, then Jesus mixed saliva and clay and told the man to wash in the pool of Siloam, and the man returned seeing. So after these things, he spat on the ground, made clay from the saliva, and spread the clay on the blind man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent, picking up on he is the living water, was saying that he was the imagery fulfilling the Feast of Tabernacles, where the water came from exactly the same source that the priests would bring up. It would come from the spring of Gihon, they would bring it up, and they'd have their water ceremony, and he taught on himself as a living water. And here, water that's coming from that same source, Jesus is using in the process of giving this man life. It's not that the water is magical, and it's not that the saliva or the clay was magical. Jesus is the one who's doing the healing, but he is giving object lessons along the way. I'm really not in a position to comment on why did he use clay, why did he use saliva. No position to say anything about that. But I do think that the religious leaders thought that he was doing a lot of work as he mixed this up in his fingers there to put on the man's eyes. Now we're down in the area where this man has grown up, because a blind person is not going to be traveling long distances. He's going to be there on a street that's close by where people are going to be going back and forth. And I have an idea what road he probably would have parked himself on. It's kind of the main road out of Jerusalem as you're going down from the upper city down through the lower city. He's going to park himself, and there are going to be people who would be traversing that route, and they would see him, that he was always there begging for money. And so we have neighbors, people that live right there, and then we also have people that happen to travel by on a regular basis, so they've seen this man. And so neighbors and some who had previously seen the blind man begging recognize him as the same person. But there are others that said, I don't think so. It's got to be someone who just looks like him, because have you ever heard of anyone being given sight that was born blind? But all along, the man was saying, I'm the one. I used to be begging because I used to be blind. Now I see. They weren't all that anxious to accept his testimony. So they thought, well, guess we need to bring him to the synagogue. It's not like the movie was picturing it, of him being brought to the temple and being brought before the Sanhedrin. This is in front of his local synagogue officials, who are going to be Judean Pharisees. And so in verses 10 and 11, they ask him how it is that he was healed. And he said, actually they haven't yet brought him there, but he answered and said, a man named Jesus made clay, spread it on my eyes, and told me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So when I went and washed, I received my sight. And they said to him, where is he? I don't know. And it got me. No idea. If I went off to the pool of Siloam, I don't know where he went. As I was off on an errand, he went wherever he went. And he doesn't have a clue. So now the people brought him there to see the Pharisees. Not because they were figuring that something bad was going to happen to him and so on and so forth, but they figured, okay, we can't figure out what really happened. Maybe the people at the synagogue can get it figured out. So they brought him to the synagogue that Sabbath day. And the Pharisees asked, well, how he was healed. And he said that Jesus put clay on his eyes, he washed, and now he sees. So they brought the man, verse 13, who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. Now it was Sabbath when Jesus made clay. Wow, Jesus really worked hard and opened his eyes. So once again, the Pharisees also asked him how he received his sight. And he said, he put clay on my eyes, I washed, and I see. Well, at this point, rather than dealing with something miraculous has happened, they're wanting to go a different direction. They're thinking, wait a moment, Sabbath breakers can't be from God. Remember how that argument was raised against Jesus in John chapter 5 when Jesus healed the man who had been lame for 38 years? And what was it that Jesus said? My Father has been working until now, and I also work. Jesus had the right to do this because of who his Father is. His Father is God. His Father was not under the Sabbath rule, neither is Jesus. But they raised the objection and said, well, this obviously proves that he's not from God. But others said, how can a sinful man perform such miraculous signs? Notice the plural. Perform such miraculous signs. These people had undoubtedly witnessed other signs that Jesus did on his trips down to Jerusalem and have reached favorable conclusions about Jesus. Notice there's a division among them. So then, in verse 17, Pharisees asked the man, well, what do you think about Jesus? And he said that he is a prophet. So they said to the man again, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? So he said, he's a prophet. Well, they didn't like hearing that. So they continued doubting that he was actually a person who had been healed, that he had really been blind, until they called his parents to testify, who acknowledged that he was their son and that he was born blind. So notice, but the Judeans, proper translation, did not believe concerning him that he was blind and received sight until they summoned the parents of the one who had received his sight. Then they asked him, is this your son, whom you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? And his parents answered them, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. At that point, they're having to say, the man has testified that he is the one that was born blind. People who are his neighbors and people who have seen him before as they've gone along this road are saying it's the same one. And the parents say it's the same one. So I guess he really used to be blind. Now he sees. They stop fighting over that issue. At that point, they do believe. Notice that John has said that until they called the parents, they disbelieved that a miracle had occurred. Well, now it becomes a matter of trying to prove that it wasn't a miracle from God. But they do recognize that something spectacular has occurred. In verses 21 through 23, the parents did not say how he was healed or who healed him, but said to ask him because he was of age. Now, the reason that they said that was because they knew that the Judean officials of their synagogue had already decided to banish people from the synagogue who confessed Jesus as the Christ. So they are afraid to say the whole truth, so they're only going to say as much as they themselves can testify. So after all, let's say that they had been witnesses of Jesus putting the clay on his eyes and saying, go to the pool. Unless they accompanied him, they wouldn't have known that this actually occurred in exactly the way that the man said. So even though he's their son, they're being rather skittish and rather evasive to say, we don't want to answer that, because they didn't want to be pushed out of the synagogue. That would be a very difficult thing for them in their circumstances. So reading starting at verse 21, but how it is that he can now see, we don't know. And who opened his eyes? We don't know. He is of age. Ask him. His parents said these things because they were afraid of the Judeans, for the leaders, that is, the leaders of their synagogue, had already decided that if anyone confessed him to be the Christ, he would be barred from the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. Now, there's another little difference with the film that we need to make note of in verse 24. They resummoned the man who had been blind. It was not that the blind man heard his parents say, yes, indeed, he is our son, but we don't know how he was healed or who healed him. They had to resummon the man. They had to bring him back there to face them, which makes it so that what the man says and what the parents say are independent witnesses that are corroborating each other. Because do notice, verse 24 starts that they summoned him again. Pharisees summoned the man again and put him under an oath before pronouncing Jesus to be a sinner. So the man did not hear his parents' testimony. So there are actually three witnesses to his identity that have appeared here in this court: the father, the mother, and the man himself as independent witnesses. He is no longer being questioned over whether he really had been blind. Now, the statement, give glory to God, is a way of saying, give glory to God by telling the truth, not telling some sort of a lie. They're putting him under an oath. They are wanting him to speak the truth. And so in verse 24, it reads, so a second time they summoned the man who had been blind and told him, give glory to God, we know that this man is a sinner. Now that's obviously the people that were speaking from the standpoint of, since this happened on the Sabbath, he has to be a sinner. Well, the man said he couldn't comment on whether Jesus was a sinner or not, but reasserted that there was one thing he did know, that he was formerly blind, but now he sees. So he answered, whether or not he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see. The man's comprehension and what it is that he's saying about Jesus becomes more and more forceful as time goes on. You know, the first thing that they ask him, where is he? Who is it that healed him? I don't know. I mean, no idea. But as he's coming along, he's starting to perceive more and more truth about Jesus. He's affirmed that he believes that he's a prophet, and he's affirming here that Jesus has indeed done an astounding sign in giving him life. I mean, eyesight again, eyesight, because he had never seen before. So they pressed the point. They repeated the question of how Jesus had healed him. And he said that he had already testified on that point, but they had not really listened. He doubted, though, that they really wanted to become disciples of Jesus, even if their question might make it seem at the surface otherwise. Now, it is interesting, we'll note, that he identifies himself implicitly as a disciple of Jesus. In verse 27, when they asked, how did he open your eyes? I already told you, and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You don't want to become his disciples too, do you? Well, that prompted a retort from them. They reviled him as a disciple of Jesus, a man that they said had questionable origins, whereas they were disciples of Moses, to whom God had clearly spoken. So they reviled him again in verse 28. You are that fellow's disciples, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but this fellow, we don't even know where he's from. Now, in chapter 7, there had been a group of Pharisees that said that they did know where Jesus was from and used that as an attempt to say, therefore, he can't be the Messiah. This is not necessarily the same group of Pharisees, because we saw that the group in chapter 8 is different than the ones here that are the synagogue officials. The same can be said here, that they can well be a different group. But it is interesting. We do have them claiming not to have any idea where Jesus came from. I would think that they're probably saying, well, we don't think he's from God. I think that that's safe enough to say. Well, in response, the man pointed out the irony of them not knowing Jesus' origins, even though Jesus opened his eyes, something that no one had ever done before. But God does not work through sinners in this way, so certainly Jesus is from God. He's made a rather tight argument that here they are supposed to be knowledgeable, and they can't explain Jesus' origins, they can't explain the miracle that's been done, but he would say that the only one who could do such a miracle is someone who was from God. And he's saying, I don't get it. You guys are supposed to be the authorities. You're supposed to be the knowledgeable ones, and I seem to know more than you. So as we read verses 30 to 33, this is a remarkable thing. You don't know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. And we know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he listens to him. Since time began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he wouldn't be able to do anything. Well, as you can imagine, the Pharisees at this synagogue were not happy. So they retorted against him that as one born blind, he was entirely born in sin. Notice they've gone back to the original question, the same line of thinking that Jesus' disciples had said. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They have the same line of thinking. Same line of thinking as the disciples had in their initial question. So they charge him with being entirely born in sin, as verified by the fact that he was born blind. So they scoff that as such a great sinner, he could not correct their understanding. So therefore, they excommunicated him from the synagogue. So, as it reads, they told him, you were totally born in sin and you were trying to teach us. So they threw him out. This is what the parents had feared, but I don't get the impression that this man is regarding this as the awful catastrophe that his parents had regarded it as being. Now, fortunately, though, Jesus was still around. It was still safe for Jesus because he was too far away for the religious leaders that were at the temple to pursue him. Jesus is able to take the necessary time to be able to minister to this man. So, Jesus heard that they had excommunicated him from the synagogue. So he asked him if he believed in the Son of God. The verse reads, Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, he asked him, do you believe in the Son of God? Now, if you're reading from some translations, it may say Son of Man. Well, Son of Man is also a title of deity, but the better manuscripts would read Son of God. Well, the man was unable to affirm that. You know, he's been very careful not to say anything that he didn't know. When he was asked, where is he? Don't know. When he's asked questions, if he's not able to comment on it, he says, I don't know. And at this point, he makes it clear that Jesus is going to need to inform him about the Son of God in order that he may believe in him. And Jesus did so. The man asked for Jesus to clarify the identity of the Son of God so that he could believe in him. And Jesus replied that he has seen him. This formerly blind man has seen the Son of God and that he is speaking with him. So replying, he said, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Then Jesus said to him, you have both seen him and he is the one who is speaking to you. So the man declared his faith in Jesus as the Son of God. Now notice, earlier in the passage. What was it? Why was it that the parents had been afraid to say that they knew how he had been healed and who healed him? It was because anyone who confessed him as the Christ would be thrown out of that synagogue. Notice, is not John and is not Jesus drawing a linkage between Son of God and Christ or Messiah? Confessing him as the Christ would result in people being excommunicated. And Jesus asks this man a question that leads to him confessing Jesus as the Son of God. When we think about the purpose statement in John's Gospel, John chapter 20, verse 31, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. The two terms are closely linked. In John chapter 4, Jesus presented himself to the Samaritan woman at the well as the Messiah. Here he's presenting him as himself as Son of God, with it being mentioned in context that he is the Christ as well. The two terms are very, very closely linked together. And that's why John puts them together. Also, we think about Martha's confession in John chapter 11. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall not die unto eternity. Do you believe this? And Martha said, yes, Lord. I have already believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one who is to come into the world. Notice how these are linked together. As the Son of God, as the Messiah, he is the one who has the power of life. He is the one who is able to give sight to the blind and life to the dead. Well, when the man declared his faith in Jesus as the Son of God, Jesus said that he came into this world for judgment, namely, that the blind may see and the seeing may be blinded. Verse 39, I came into this world for judgment so that those who do not see may see, and that those who do see may become blind. Jesus consistently was putting forth the evidence of who he is and that he keeps his promise to guarantee life forever for believers. But what happened? Some saw the evidence and saw it as true. They believed it. And others saw the same evidence and they could say, oh, well, it couldn't be a great miracle from God because it happened on a Sabbath. God doesn't work on Sabbaths. They could excuse away and ignore all of the evidence that God was giving them. They could see, and yet they did not see. It has been said that a blind person is not a person who lacks sight, but a person who lacks vision. The difference is, being truly blind is unable to perceive the truth when it's right there. Listen to that again. The one who is blind is not the one who lacks sight, but the one who lacks vision, the one who can't perceive, the one who misses the point. And what is an unbeliever? An unbeliever is a professional at missing the point. They've spent their whole life missing the point. Well, there were Pharisees that were present with Jesus at that time, and they scoffed that he might be calling them blind, so he told them that their culpability remains because they pronounced themselves to be sighted. And some of the Pharisees who were with him, verse 40, heard these things and asked him, "We aren't blind too, are we? If you were blind, you wouldn't have sin. But now you say, 'We see.' Therefore, your sin remains." Jesus is here saying, you recognize that there's something to be seen here. You recognize that there's a point to be caught, and you're missing it. You declare yourselves culpable. These people also wanted to do Jesus in. These people were not convinced that Jesus was who he said he is, because they thought that doing a miracle on the Sabbath proved that Jesus was not who he said he was. They could look at a big truth and miss it because they didn't know how to explain that it happened on a Saturday or that it happened on the eighth day of the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, when we look at Alex Davis, he started out life and lived it for 23 years, unable to see. It was quite a challenge for him, and it was a fearful experience when he first was able to see. And we look at that and we say that it's truly spectacular to live in an age where medical science can do something like that. But look at what Jesus did. He gave a man sight, not with surgical instruments, but as a sign from God as to who he is, as the Messiah, the Son of God, the life giver. But how easy it is for people to look at him sideways and able to see, but not able to perceive. Seeing, but blind. Jesus offers everlasting life to those who simply believe in him. He guarantees everlasting life to those who believe in him. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life. Jesus, the light of the world. And look at all the people with blinders. We need to pray that God will use his word, in particular the Gospel of John, to open people's eyes as we share it with them.